It may be hard to fathom now, but there was a time when Americans typically received news about a war by going to the movie theater. This was especially popular during World War II.
Below decks, Yankee pilots received final instructions, each eager to take off to meet the enemy shot for shot.
Newsreels were government-approved short films that played before the movie started. The main goal of the newsreel was to get information and news out to as many people as possible.
The island contains a vital airstrip and places MacArthur's forces many miles closer to the Philippines. Signal Corps pictures show the general inspecting the strategic prize.
Years later, television changed our viewing habits.
American soldiers hiking their way through the sweaty jungles of South Vietnam, searching for an elusive enemy.
The temperature. But the stories weren't live. They were filmed and often arrived in newsrooms days later.
At 3 o'clock tomorrow morning, Operation Desert Storm will complete its second week.
In 1991, cable news was ushering in the 24-hour news cycle, and the Gulf War became one of the most heavily televised wars in history. But in many respects, U.S. policy regarding media freedom was more restrictive than during the Vietnam War. Most of the press information came from briefings organized by the military.
In our first phase, what we wanted to do was disrupt leadership, command, and control.
Only selected journalists were allowed to visit the front lines or conduct interviews with soldiers.
In the air and on the ground to achieve air superiority.
By 2003, during the Iraq War, the philosophy had changed, and so had the technology. Journalists now had the ability to broadcast live from virtually anywhere in a war zone, as former NBC News correspondent Kerry Sanders did.
At this point, you're just waiting for more orders and you've taken a defensive position, correct?
Yes, that's correct. We started digging in. We're going to take in defensive position right now.
Okay, thank you very much. We're going to back ourselves up here so we're not interrupting this Marine's job because he's got a battle to fight there.
Kerry Sanders joined us to talk about how television coverage in the Iraq War was different than previous wars. He also told us how his access to soldiers on the ground provided him with exclusive information about a story that the Defense Intelligence Agency is quite proud of.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the DIA Museum. We're going to take you through all of
the Defense Intelligence Agency Museum is located at DIA's headquarters in Washington, D.C. It covers six decades of DIA history.
One of the things you'll notice is that we go.
It's designed around several themes, each addressing key areas in the Department of Defense and the intelligence community, where the agency plays an important role.
This exhibit is called Bringing Them Home. This is where we talk about DIA's role in prisoners of war or missing in action missions that happen around the world. Not a lot of people are aware that DIA is actually the lead intelligence community organization for this mission set.
The Bringing Them Home exhibit in our museum is really one of the most poignant and sometimes emotional exhibits that we have in our entire museum.
That's DIA historian Paul Isaacson. He'll be joining us on this episode to talk about the agency's intelligence gathering role in the POW-MIA mission and how DIA helped save a soldier's life during the Iraq War.
One of our featured stories here in the Bringing Them Home section is on Private First Class Jessica Lynch. She and her unit during Operation Iraqi Freedom were unfortunately ambushed when part of a convoy got separated from the rest of the unit. She was grievously injured in that ambush and taken to a Saddam Hussein hospital. Later, operators learned about her whereabouts, her location, and so DIA and other agencies started putting together a plan to rescue her.
This is DIA Connections.
For the first time ever, stories from the battlefield broadcast live.
This was a very raw, live feed of what was happening. Could there be incoming? Could you get killed? Could they get killed or shot on camera as this is all happening live on television?
A plan was developed to send this Iraqi attorney back into the hospital with a hidden camera to gather more information.
If you'd like to take a closer look at the bag and look for the hidden camera, you can see that our Office of Technical Operations put it on the side of the bag to make it indistinguishable from anything you would normally see on a gym bag.
You're doing great, Jessica. You're doing wonderful. Just like I told you, we're on a plane now, and we're going to go to Kuwait.
Thanks for joining us on DIA Connections. We're calling this one Candid Cameras. On March 23rd, 2003, 3 days after the invasion of Iraq began, tragedy struck.
Combat operations have met with resistance in a number of locations, the most notable of which is in the vicinity of An-Nasiriyah.
18 trucks carrying 33 soldiers from the 507th Maintenance Company were traveling across the Iraqi desert at the rear of a 600-vehicle convoy. 3 days in, they lost ground and became separated. Determined to catch up with the rest of the company, they took a series of wrong turns, which left them hopelessly lost and behind enemy lines. They were ambushed by Iraqi military and non-military personnel. 11 American soldiers were killed, and 8 others were captured and became prisoners of war. Jessica Lynch was one of those prisoners. She suffered severe injuries and was taken to a hospital in Baghdad. She was rescued 9 days later. In a few minutes, you'll learn about the clever way the DIA gathered intelligence to help make that rescue successful. But first, here's someone who knew about the rescue ahead of time, but didn't tell a soul.
NBC's Kerry Sanders and his team in An-Nasiriyah had known for days that a top-secret rescue mission was in the works.
I was aware of there going to be a raid, and I was invited to come along with the Marines, and I was asked not to report it.
That's our featured guest, Kerry Sanders. He was on the ground in Iraq, working as a correspondent for NBC News. You'll hear his reports on the show. Kerry, along with other members of the media, were beneficiaries of a new Pentagon policy.
Journalists who were, in the language of the Pentagon, embedded with U.S. forces, their access was unprecedented.
Reporters were able to get up close to warfighters on the battlefield like never before. That's why Kerry had exclusive knowledge of the Lynch rescue mission.
I just had a trusting relationship that allowed the military to believe that I would not jeopardize them, and at the same token, they would not exclude me from information.
Google Jessica Lynch, and you'll find plenty of articles about the first female American POW to be rescued.
A senior Army official tells NBC News tonight that this U.S. Army soldier who was rescued is 19-year-old Private First Class Jessica Lynch of Palestine, West Virginia.
The story received a lot of media coverage. A few months after her release, there was even a movie. You can find it on YouTube. It's called Saving Jessica Lynch.
She's an American.
That's it. That's it, boy.
That's her.
Bingo.
Okay, let's go. Let's get her out of there, boys.
Coming out.
There's a lot of stories about her capture, but there's one important detail about the rescue that's usually overlooked. But that's okay, because Jessica wasn't aware of it either. In fact, she wrote about it in a note she sent to the agency. It's engraved on the wall of the DIA Museum. It says,
"The Defense Intelligence Agency was an integral part of my rescue in Iraq. Looking back to April 1, 2003, I was not aware of the number of individuals and agencies involved in the efforts to liberate me. I cannot thank the DIA enough for what they did that day."
Well, that begs the question, what did we do? So we talked to historian Paul Isaacson to help break it down for us. All right, Paul, let's talk about the circumstances behind what happened to Jessica Lynch.
Okay.
The 507th Maintenance Company were soldiers that were mechanics and truck drivers, technicians, cooks. They were half a day behind a march column of close to 600 vehicles. And that's when the trouble started. Start there and tell us what happened.
Picture yourself, you're in a foreign country. The signs and directions, they're not in English. The maps are imperfect. and they just simply got lost. They took a wrong turn. They find themselves on a street in Nasiriyah, and they are now behind enemy lines, and they come under an attack, an armed attack from Iraqis. Essentially, they were ambushed. They came under fire, small arms fire, as well as RPG, rocket propelled grenade fire.
Yeah. Hey, all are up there, Tom.
Look out, look out, look out.
11 were killed, and 8 were taken prisoner. Jessica Lynch suffered severe injuries and was taken to Saddam Hussein Hospital in Baghdad. Now, Paul, for a successful rescue mission for Lynch, we would need reliable information about her location and her condition. Tell us how that intel came knocking on the door.
Well, this was a pretty unique case because there was an Iraqi lawyer who was sympathetic to the American cause, and he actually knew the whereabouts of Jessica Lynch. He knew a little bit about her condition, and he actually approached U.S. forces at pretty great risk to himself and offered his help to rescue her.
In a little bit, we'll tell you how the Defense Intelligence Agency took full advantage of that good fortune. But first, a reintroduction of our guest, who had advanced knowledge of the Lynch rescue because of his ideal vantage point.
I'm Kerry Sanders, and I was a reporter, or as we called it, a correspondent, at NBC News for 32 years. I've had a chance to report from every state in our country. And then, of course, I had the opportunity to cover the war in Iraq.
Kerry reported on various battles during the Iraq War for NBC's Nightly News and the Today Show. Some of the most compelling included the harsh 11-day conflict in Nasiriyah.
U.S. military commanders say this continuing fight for control of the bridge and the critical route north will likely last for days to come. Their fear is that will result in more U.S. Marine casualties.
From desert battlefields in Iraq into homes across America, the coverage was groundbreaking for two reasons. First, it was the unprecedented access.
We have to get down on this bridge as much as we can stand up on it because of snipers.
And second was the advancement of cutting-edge technology.
The NBC News team relied on satellite phones, video phones that worked through laptop computers, and video uplink dishes.
This allowed Kerry to go live from anywhere at any time.
New York, this is Kerry.
Thanks for joining us, Kerry. I want to start by asking you how you felt about covering a war in a way that hadn't happened before.
If Vietnam was the first living room war, this war in 2003 would be the first live war. We had the ability of me literally crawling in that type of military crawl that you do where you have your arms down and your elbow hand over hand, crawling up to members of the Marines with their rifles pointed at the enemy. And this is live on the air.
And why do you think the rules changed this time around? Why do they give journalists so much more freedom? Normally, things are kept close to the vest.
I think the Department of Defense recognized that we were going to cover the story no matter what. And there is a technological improvement that's taken place where we have a greater ability to go live. This was a very raw live feed of what was happening. Could there be incoming? Could you get killed? Could they get killed or shot on camera as this is all happening live on television?
What do you see out there in the distance?
Right now we're seeing a white building. There's some civilians out there. If we do engage into a firefight, the life will be in jeopardy.
And so the networks go to the Pentagon and say, why don't we try something different? And the Pentagon says, we've been thinking about this ourselves. We're going to do something called embedded reporters.
With their unprecedented access, the embeds gave us what we had never seen before. A fascinating, very close-up look at modern-day war.
embedding was you would be joining these troops and you would be staying with them as long as you possibly could. In my case, I was with the Marines.
Since you needed a good working relationship with leadership on the ground to maintain your access, I'm wondering if you think that influenced your objectivity.
I am, as a reporter, detached. I have to make sure that this is not a rah-rah report. This is an independent report of what's happening. To understand what a reporter does when you're embedded, if I can give you a visual, pick up a straw that you drink with and look in that straw at whatever you're looking at, and that's all you see is that tiny little area. So I'm not able to report on the big picture of what's happening in this war, but I am able to give you a very narrow view as an embedded reporter with the Marines of what's happening in that tiny little environment. With all of that said, I'm able to talk to you today because those Marines saved my life. I certainly recognize who they are. I'm not wearing a uniform. I'm not carrying a gun. I am an American. I'm proud of what they did. But as a reporter in that moment, I am attempting at my very best to be a reporter who is removed from anything other than what I see and explaining what is happening.
Many reporters, photographers, and camera crews took that hard journey to Baghdad. I think it is fair to say that the journalists grew to respect the skill and bravery and decency of the men and women who wear our nation's uniform.
Very few people have experienced what it's like to be on the ground at the beginning of a war. What was that feeling like for you, and what were you thinking?
I guess when that green light goes off and you realize this is actually happening, as we crossed across the border, as there were illuminations in the sky, as there was quite a bit of rat-a-tat-tat associated with what sounds like fireworks, actually. The first thing I thought to myself was, I never thought that I would be traveling with the military, crossing the border, and invading another country. My experience and my history and everything that I had read since grade school never suggested to me that my country would be invading another country.
Conserve your ammunition!
Now, let me ask you this. Did you think the prevailing sentiment was that it would be over quickly, without too much resistance?
I think the answer to that question is who you're asking. Obviously, the officers were under the impression that the overwhelming power of the military would meet very little resistance. The greater concern, of course, was nuclear, biological, and chemical. And you're often hearing gas, 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 which means you got to get your mask out and mask up. But the concern that the resistance by the Iraqi military, the Fayyadin, the folks who would be holding weapons and shooting back at the Marines, the general sense was it wouldn't be much. And of course, it turns out there's a huge resistance there.
Vehicles approaching from the east, CAT! It's CAT vehicles from the east!
Carey spent considerable time with wounded soldiers. Surprisingly, he was able to comfort them right there in the middle of the Iraqi desert in a very unusual way.
The Navy corpsmen are treating these guys who've been shot, and we're standing back shooting, and then I go up, can we approach? Can we come up? And the Navy corpsman says, yeah. I said, can I talk to him? And he goes, sure, you can talk to him, but you better hurry up because I'm about to give him some morphine. He's been hit. How are you?
I'm all right. Just hurts pretty bad.
And I ask him, you know, first of all, how are you doing? What do you want? And the first thing he says to me is, I want to talk to my mother. And we're in the middle of nowhere, in a desert, south of Nasiriya. And I thought to myself, I have a satellite phone in my pocket. And I said, what's her phone number? And I called her on the phone and I said, stand by. And I handed the phone to this young Marine.
I just wanted to call and talk to you. I'm okay. I got shot in the hand, so I got to have surgery on it. The bullet's still in my hand, but other than that, I'm okay.
And they had that kind of conversation that I think is incredibly impactful. And I will tell you, nobody at the Pentagon who allowed for embedded reporters, they never in their wildest dreams imagined that somebody who has been wounded in war is going to be calling back and speaking to their family. The military has a very strict set of guidelines of how that notification takes place. And it does not take place with a satellite phone laying in the desert with a Navy corpsman treating you for the wound.
Kerry, on the third day of Operation Iraqi Freedom, the 507th Maintenance Company was ambushed. When was the first time you heard about Jessica Lynch?
I found out about the possibility of an American being held when I was out with the Marines on a story, and this man approached us, an Iraqi dressed in traditional clothing, but who spoke very good English. And so he came to me and said, I just need to let you know that there is an American who is being held in the hospital. And it was a very short conversation. I mean, this was not a very deep piece of information. It was just that there is an American being held there.
And what did you do with that information? Is that something you'd report on the air for NBC?
I went back to the XO and to the lieutenant colonel, and I said, look, I don't know what this piece of information means, but I need to tell you what this guy told me. And I wasn't sure after giving this information to the military, is that something I go on the air with or not? On the one hand, this is incredibly important information. And on the other hand, is this some sort of lie that's a trap to get members of the military to go into a location where they'll be ambushed and killed? So to me, it wasn't a news event at the moment. To me, it was, this is a piece of information that is just a fragment of something that is either really big or something that means absolutely nothing.
It was Lynch, and Kerry had an exclusive on a hot story.
When it came time to sort of get what the real story was, that's when the lieutenant colonel then clued me back in, because the Marines that I was with were now going to be support to the special forces that were going to go into where it was believed Jessica Lynch and maybe others were being held.
There were other Iraqi citizens who came forward with information about an American POW. The most notable was an Iraqi attorney whose wife worked at the hospital where Lynch was held. Here again is DIA historian Paul Isaacson to explain the next sequence of events.
So obviously, one person coming to you is not enough information to simply plan a rescue around, right? So they had to evaluate his story. They had to determine whether it was trustworthy. I think a casual observer might think, hey, you've got an American soldier. You've been told she's in this hospital. Go rescue her. But it's not that simple. There's a lot more information that is needed to make a successful rescue operation. A plan was developed to send this Iraqi attorney back into the hospital for a second time with a hidden camera to gather more information.
All right, tell us more about the hidden camera. How does DIA get involved with that?
Yeah, so by way of a little background, DIA has a science and technology division. And a small part of that science and technology division is a smaller office called OTO, the Office of Technical Operations. And these men and women are the people that hide hidden devices, cameras, recorders, sensors. They hide them in furniture, in clothing. And so there was a DIA officer there from this group that was able to quickly get a gym bag, a very innocuous looking regular black bag, and he installed a small battery powered video camera into that bag and gave it to this attorney, who then went into the hospital, and everywhere he went in the hospital, he was carrying that bag and recording video footage that was giving the soon-to-be rescue team everything they needed to be successful.
And what information were they hoping to learn from the video to make them successful?
Well, a few things. One, we were looking to verify proof of life. The mission changes if, unfortunately, if Jessica Lynch has passed away recently. The second thing we needed to determine is, what is her condition, right? What is needed to actually rescue her? Is she ambulatory? Can she walk? Can she run? Is she unconscious? Finally, we needed to understand the security, the guards, the guns, the layout of the hospital.
Looking good. Tony, searching the highway. They should be stopping right now. I got you.
The time had come for the first ever rescue of an American female POW.
Come on, man. Let's get this girl.
Intelligence from the hidden camera video provided enough details of the hospital's interior for Task Force 121 to locate her.
Touchdown. Over.
It's touchdown.
Touchdown meant they found her. But she was severely injured.
Are you in any pain? Where is those windows going?
It took just 30 minutes from the hospital room.
You got that flag still?
Down the stairs. And onto the waiting helicopter.
Make sure we get a good count, guys, or she comes in.
Then came the words that Jessica was praying to hear.
You're doing great, Jessica. You're doing wonderful. Just like I told you, we're on a plane now, and we're going to go to Kuwait.
It was one of the most dramatic moments of the war. Private First Class Jessica Lynch rescued under the cover of darkness by U.S. Special Forces.
Jessica would soon arrive in Germany for medical evaluation and to begin her long road to recovery. For journalist Kerry Sanders, the story didn't end there. He was still embedded with the Marines, and a few days after the Lynch rescue, he went with them to the hospital where she had been held.
At some point, the decision is made that the Marines will go in and take a look around.
We're in a room here in the hospital that has a bed, but it also has some other things here. Staff Sergeant, what does this mean to you when you see this battery here?
We assume that it may have been a torture chamber or some sort of a torture device.
Inside the hospital, the Marines made another grim discovery.
And the other thing that we saw when we were going through here is what appeared to be all of these kind of elements that might be building nuclear, chemical, some sort of biological weapon. And here I am and I'm seeing all this sort of stuff. This doesn't look like any hospital I've ever seen. We think that maybe this is the first visual evidence that there was indeed an effort to build these weapons that caused the United States to cross into Iraq to begin with.
That hospital was also the scene of a somber moment, which took place prior to Sanders' arrival.
During the raid, they got new information on the location of the 11 soldiers who had been killed. They got information on where their remains were. Those soldiers had been buried in an athletic field very close to the hospital. And so it was a grim task for these Americans to exhume these bodies, dig them up out of the ground, and bring them home.
Not everyone from the 507th Maintenance Company was accounted for. Some soldiers survived the ambush, but their whereabouts were a mystery. Included in that group was Specialist Shoshana Johnson.
They took us to Baghdad, took most of the day. They stopped along in every little city to show off their captives. I was slapped, I was spit on. We were always blindfolded, hands tied. I was definitely terrified.
On the next episode, Shoshana Johnson joins us for a frank conversation about the 22 days she spent in captivity. She also discusses her life after the war and how she copes with post-traumatic stress disorder.
PTSD is a chronic disease. There is just no cure. It's something that's going to pop up for the rest of your life. Something's going to trigger a memory you probably haven't thought of in years, and you're going to have a reaction to it. And reaching out for mental health help is not a weakness, it is a strength.
Shoshana's story is on the next episode of DIA Connections. As always, thanks for listening.